Started.
And happy Hanukkah. We're already halfway there. I find the first couple nights of Hanukkah, you really appreciate each night, individually, and then the last couple days kind of fly by, so we should be able to maximize our appreciation of the entire holiday of Hanukkah. And Hanukkah is probably the best known Jewish holiday to the broader world, maybe just because it's at the time of the year that it falls out on. But it's usually up there with people's favorite holidays, at least as kids. And it's one of the earliest stories that we learn. You know, we all know the basics, at least the conclusion that we went to war with the Greeks and the Syrian Greeks. And we were a smaller army, but we miraculously were victorious. And then after we were able to go back into the base of Mikdash, we only found one jug of oil that was tahor, that was pure. We can talk about a little bit more about the significance of that. And the oil miraculously burned for 8 days. The oil that was supposed to last for 1 day burned for 8 days. And as we've been watching the different news features at the JCC event on Sunday, so we've heard that a couple times. I gave that, Dan gave that, he represented. That's basically this story of Hanukkah. But is it just this nice story about the underdog winning? And, you know, it's cool that the oil lasted for 8 days, but, you know, why is it so significant? And it has to be significant because there were actually, in our times, really only are familiar with, you only really only observe the rabbinic holidays, or at least non-Torah holidays of Purim and Hanukkah. And on those days, there's customs of celebration and restrictions on mourning and on fasting and giving eulogies. But there actually used to be, in the times of the second base of Mikdash, there were many holidays like these where hespedim, where eulogies were forbidden, where it was forbidden to fast. And this was all, they were all collected in a book called Megillas Tainus, literally the Megillah, the collection of fasting, meaning on days that fasting wasn't allowed because they were celebratory days. And the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us that the other days that were listed in this Megillas Tainus were all nullified after the destruction of the temple. There was really no significance except for Hanukkah and Purim. And it means that if we're still celebrating Hanukkah, it must have significance beyond just the temporary relief of the that it provided at the time, and the whether it's a military victory or the miracle of the oil, but it has a significance to us in our lives. And I think if we consider some of the main themes of Hanukkah, we can see that not only can we still relate to it, but I would argue that it has increasing relevance to our lives in our contemporary world, our lives as Jews. It has, I think, increasing relevance as the years go by. It's not just an old story that we tell and we appreciate and that's inspiring, but really the lessons are very, very significant for us and are very important for us to really pay attention to. And I'll put the link to the source sheet, I'll put it in the chat, also share the screen. So there are some very powerful descriptions of Hanukkah. The Rambam, in his Laws of Hanukkah, uses a language that he doesn't use in other places. And he says that the mitzvah ner Hanukkah, mitzvah chavivahi ad ma'od, that the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles is exceedingly precious. You know, all mitzvahs, all mitzvos are precious, all mitzvos are important, but he uses language of exceedingly precious, and he says that the person should be very careful in the mitzvah and even go above and beyond what's required for the fulfillment of other mitzvos, which is generally, in order to do a positive mitzvah, one has to spend up to a fifth of their of their income. And if it's too expensive, if you know, Lou Venice are too expensive, if they're more than a fifth, so then we don't have an obligation to purchase them. But when it comes to the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles, so a person has to even, you know, sell the shirt off his back, has to even if someone who is supported by charity, which we say that they should maybe be more limited in how they spend, if it's not absolutely required, it is still has to spend whatever they have to have to fill the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles. So we have to ask, why is the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles, and obviously what it represents, the miracle of Hanukkah, why is it so precious? We'll use the words of the Rambam that it's chaviva hi ad ma'od, that it's exceedingly precious. Why would we have such a special characterization of this mitzvah and of Hanukkah in general? Any ideas? What's so special about Hanukkah, or what's really the importance of the miracle of Hanukkah?
That we were able to keep our identity even though we had so much against us.
Keeping our identity, I think it's a very important piece of it, that we're keeping our, you know, our identity was threatened. It was threatened physically, legally, and we were able to keep it. And therefore, the mitzvos surrounding it have to be treated with care and appreciation. I think it's very true. So we just consider what Hanukkah is. What's the main point of Hanukkah? Because, you know, sometimes with Hanukkah, with some other holidays as well, you know, there are kind of a lot of things going on. There's the war, there's the decree, there's the influence of the Greeks, there's the influence of the Hellenized Jews, there's the miracle of the oil. So there's a lot of, you know, interesting and, you know, and the nice concepts, but what, you know, is there a common thread that ties all of these things together? The events leading up to the war and the miracle of the oil. So in our sources, whether it's from the Gemara, from the prayer of Allah Nisim and other sources as well, there are different emphases on what's really the main point of Hanukkah. Look on the sheet, and this in the second source, the Gemara and Shabbos, actually, after having a discussion about several laws pertaining to Hanukkah, the Gemara asks, "My Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah?" And as Rashi says, it means, what miracle was the catalyst for the holiday to be established? So it tells the basic story that the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oils, then the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, overcame them, they were victorious, they found one cruse of oil with the seal of the high priest that hadn't been contaminated, and it was only enough to light for one day, and it remained lit for 8 days. And then it says, L'shana acheres kva'um v'asom yamim tovim v'hal avodah. The next year, they established it into a holiday with Hallel and Hodah, with Hallel, either the chapters of Tehillim of Hallel, and Hodah, Thanksgiving, Rashi says, means Al HaNisim, with special tefillos, and of course the observances of the Neiros Chanukah, of the Chanukah candles. So what seems to be missing from the Talmud's account of the story of Hanukkah? So look, it really doesn't say anything about the war. It really focuses exclusively on the fact that the oil and the sanctuary itself, the different components were contaminated and contaminated. So we'll talk about what's this contamination, what's this tuma. So there are different perspectives of what exactly it was, that there's one element that the it was decreed that all basically all you know, Gentiles who were dealing with these things had the a type of impurity, a type of tumah that would be associated with a bodily admission. There's another idea quoted by the Beis Yosef that the Jews themselves who entered the sanctuary had been fighting in wars and were tamei meis, where tamei were impure by contact with a dead body. But the Gemara itself really emphasizes that aspect, really the religious aspect, the fact that the different parts of the sanctuary and the oil were made to be tamei, to be spiritually impure, and the miracle of the oil. Not so much about the military victory. The Rambam in the third source gives a little bit of more of a complete picture. He says that what was the background of this, that in the times of the Second Temple, the Greek kingdom issued a decree against the Jewish people causing them to nullify the, you know, demanding that they nullify their faith and wouldn't let them be involved in the study of Torah. So what was going on in the world at this time? So a brief history. So for already about 150 years before this, in around 300 or so BCE, Alexander the Great goes into Jerusalem, and his intention is to conquer and to occupy Jerusalem and in Israel, just like the rest of the world, and most of the rest of the world at that point. And the Gemara tells that he had this encounter with Shimon HaTzadik, one of the great sages, and took a liking to him, and then basically let Judea off easy. He realized that they had something going on, something of value, and he treated them well. So for the time of Alexander the Great himself, and a little bit afterwards, the Jews were, you know, not really subjugated, at least politically. Then after Alexander the Great dies, and I think he was only 33 when he died, then the kingdom split in two between the one faction was the Seleucids, the Syrian Greeks, and about about 100 or so years later, there the Seleucids, the Syrian Greeks, actually you know, more forcibly took control of Judea, of Eretz Yisrael. And during this whole time period, even going back to the times of Alexander the Great and even before, there became increasing influence of Greek culture in the land of Israel, just like there was in the world around the world at the time. And leading up to this period, a lot of Jews in the land of Israel became Hellenized. We're called Misyavnim, the Hellenized Jews. It even went all the way up to the priesthood. One of the high priests who adopted the name Jason also became Hellenized and very you know, involved in the Greek lifestyle and the Greek culture. But then in 199 BCE, when Antiochus the Fourth took the throne, so then the persecution against the Jews really became more official. That not only was there this influence of Greek culture, of Hellenism, but there actually became laws outlawing key aspects of Jewish practice. So this took this manifested itself in both you know, physical destruction and spiritual. The Rambam points these two elements out, that they parts of our process that they made wrought havoc, and they made vitimo taharas, and they made the pure impure, meaning they had both the physical and spiritual type of destruction. But then after the war, and the Rambam does mention the war a little bit more, then after the war, they were victorious, and the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, you know, Judah Maccabee and then this family ruled for about another 200 years until the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And of course, Hanukkah is the most recent holiday. You know, Purim was the post-Torah holiday in the period of between the first and second Beis HaMikdash, but Hanukkah was already towards the end of the period of the second Beis HaMikdash. So there was obviously this conflict between Judaism and Hellenism and Greek culture, Greek values, Greek wisdom. But I think oftentimes it's presented as, you know, a very black and white, that obviously Torah is good, you know, and that Greek wisdom, Greek culture is bad, is doesn't have value, you know, is barbaric. You know, if we view we're the good guys, they were the bad guys. What makes it a little bit more complicated is there is a certain respect that's accorded to the Greek language and even elements of Greek wisdom in the view of our sages. For example, the Torah is allowed to be written in Greek with certain specifications. It can be written in Greek. Greek is considered a language that is valid for writing a Sefer Torah. And the influence of Hellenism and even the persecution around that Hellenism was something that was very different from really anything that came before it, because it was really intellectual competition. You know, it wasn't just, you know, the types of persecution and even the types of deviations that the Jewish people, that's the elements of the Jewish people adopted in the times of the first Beis HaMikdash and in the books of the prophets, were really more just the more barbaric, idolatrous practices of the nations around them. But, you know, for whatever reason, we said that there's not the pull towards idolatry that there once was, but it didn't really seem to be, you know, an intellectually, you know, rigorous system that was competing and that was threatening to take Jews away from Torah. It was more that there were different urges, different pulls in different directions. When it came to Greece, the challenge was largely an intellectual challenge, because, you know, the Greeks established very important trends in civilization, whether it's in the sciences, mathematics, government, democracy, meaning so much of what we philosophy, so much of what we have now, so much of it has become part of our legal system, part of the basis for mathematics, and in many, many fields, probably across the spectrum, originated in Greece. So very loosely that, oh, they're just barbarians, that there's nothing to, you know, that they have nothing to offer us. So I think it oversimplifies and doesn't necessarily allow us to appreciate what the challenge was. Rav Yitzhak Kotner, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, says that you have a term for Hellenized Jews, Misyavnim. You don't have a term for, you know, Jews who accepted certain idolatrous, you know, pagan practices of Babylonia or the other civilizations. Meaning when it came to the influence of Greece, and this is something that maybe isn't always talked about as much, but a lot of the conflict between the Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, was not only with the Greeks, but was with the Hellenized Jews. And, you know, if it's the case that the Greeks were able to establish many of the important institutions, ideas, and civilization, which we in our lives, you know, even if we don't read, you know, Plato and Homer and that are, you know, directly involved with Greek culture, you know, probably have engaged in and have benefited from, you know, medicine, other things. Obviously, it's advanced since then, but, you know, the Greeks really set the foundation for a lot of the progress in the world. So if that's the case, it would seem that we ought to view it rather positively. Yet the Medrash says that the Greek civilization is characterized by choshech, by darkness. I would think the opposite, that what do we call, you know, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, that it sounds like the you know, progress or advances in human thinking, intellectual progress in sciences, mathematics, that the government, that would be lightness, that would be a positive development in the world. But there's an element of Greece that, even though Chazal do understand it to the Greece from Yefes, one of Noah's sons, to represent beauty, also represents darkness. And the Medrash there says, what was an element of this darkness, which I think characterizes a lot of the tension between, as Matthew Arnold said, between Athens and Jerusalem, meaning these two worldviews. So the Medrash says that one of the things that the Greeks during the time of the events of Hanukkah commanded, they made a decree that Kisvu al Keren Hashor Sheindachem Chelek Belokei Yisrael. Write for yourself on the horn of an ox that you have no share in the God of Israel. So what does that mean? What were the Greeks trying to do? And this becomes complicated because the Greeks valued different cultures within their empire. The Syrian Greek Emperor Ptolemy commissioned the 70 sages to translate the Torah, which is one of the events that was considered actually tragic, which on Asara B'Tevis we fast because of. But there was in the Greeks, in their civilization, in their conquering of the world, they wanted to preserve aspects of the different cultures that they were now ruling. So what were they trying to do when they commanded that the Jews should write on the horn of an ox that they have no share in the God of Israel? So there are a few aspects of this. One, and this is Sifsei Chaim in number five, points out that the one of the four exiles, the exile of the Persians, of the Romans, Babylonians, one of the four exiles, the fourth is Yavan, is Greece. And you can ask the question, well, under the Greeks, the Jews were never actually, you know, physically exiled. There was never a population that was, as a result, was sent away from the land of Israel. So why do we call it an exile? So the Sifsei Chaim explains that exile doesn't always refer to physical removal from one place and, you know, from the homeland, from Eretz Yisrael, to be sent somewhere else, but is when our connection to between God and the Jewish people is attempted to be severed or to be weakened. And during the exile, as the sages understand it, of Greece, so one of the efforts that the Greeks made and what they wanted to uproot was the idea of chosenness, the idea that the Jewish people are unique. Again, not in a way of the superiority, but in a way of connection to Hashem and role among the nations of the world. That this was something that the Greeks couldn't countenance in their value system. They, even though they appreciated the theories, the beliefs, the philosophy of Judaism, which is why they wanted to translate the Torah, they wanted to make Torah and the Jewish people, but the Jewish people's relation to Torah, really no different than any other intellectual pursuit. That They wanted just the Torah to be one part of the subculture of Greece, to be absorbed into, you know, Greek wisdom. And as a result, the Jewish people would just be, you know, one part of the Greek empire that you know, that lived in a certain place and that had a certain traditions. But they couldn't affirm and they couldn't believe that they have a portion in the God of Israel, meaning that there's a connection, a special connection between God and the Jewish people. That was one thing that the Greeks, you know, were committed to uprooting, and that creates a darkness, that weakening of connection. And you know, this is not so different than, I think, trends nowadays, and even just like there was in the times of the Greeks, you know, anyway, self-inflicted or the parts of the Jewish people embrace this, that there's a certain, you know, some ways, and the, you know, it's, to an extent, it's understandable that there's a feeling of being weighed down, that here we are, we have our own, you know, laws, our own identities, we're, you know, a little bit, you know, no matter how we you know, dress or necessarily identify within, you know, the Torah observant world, we're still going to be, by, you know, nature of Shabbos and Kashrus and, you know, basics of Jewish practice, we're still not going to be, you know, able to be totally integrated with everyone else. We're still going to be different. It's still going to be a challenge. And so in the Greek view, this was releasing the Jewish people of their, you know, of the burden on them of all of their laws, and allowing them to just be a nation, you know, among other nations. So that was one aspect. That's why it's the Greece is referred to as being representative of darkness, because they wanted to sever this idea of specialness, the idea that we have a connection with the Ribbono Shel Olam. But even when it comes to wisdom, there were different perspectives and even irreconcilable perspectives between the Greek understanding and that of the Torah. The Ramban points this out, that as wise as Aristotle was, and actually the Rambam, he disagrees with you know, certain elements, certain parts of Aristotle's thought, but he certainly, you know, doesn't say he was, you know, a barbarian. That he, in fact, the Rambam says they really reached the pinnacle of, you know, of human understanding. But the Ramban says that there was one part of their understanding of the world that he really limited them and was really irreconcilable with our beliefs, and that is, and this in number seven, that they rejected the reality, denied the reality of anything that they couldn't experience with the senses. And they believed, they had an arrogance that anything they didn't understand couldn't possibly be true. I think this is something that we also see has become popular nowadays. That there's nothing that we have the, you know, this notion that we know it all, and we've, especially you can understand at the time that the Greeks made so many advances in our understanding of the world, that anything that we don't understand, anything that's not, you know, immediately tangible to us, must not be true. And I think the whole, you know, COVID era has really shown us that there's a lot that we don't know. As advanced as we think we are, I mean, we look back, what were you doing in, you know, March 2020, and we look, you know, how primitive are the people, you know, were those people? It's like, you know, you look at former times where, you know, wiping down surfaces, but, you know, we've realized there's a lot we don't understand. You know, not just, you know, in the sciences and medicine and as far as we've come. So there, just as from an intellectual perspective, you know, there is, it is important to realize that there are things that we don't understand, but that was something that the Greeks rejected. They rejected anything that they couldn't understand. And, you know, obviously when it comes to belief in God and then serving God, so that really makes an irreconcilable conflict, that, you know, so we don't see God. There are, you know, we have to accept that there's a reality beyond what's, you know, immediately tangible. And I think the main divergence in perspectives and in values was really in the area of kedusha, of holiness, that there are some things that are special and there are distinctions that we can make. And we see this in particular with the specific mitzvos that the Greeks outlawed: Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, and Bris Milah. And each of those mitzvos represent our conviction that there's holiness. There's holiness in time. There's holiness in every week and in recognition that God created the world. There's fixing the calendar. There's sanctifying the calendar. And the fact that there is a system of a calendar and holidays that have an element of holiness. And Bris Milah, of circumcision. Also that the body that we take efforts even with our physical body to live with increased awareness of and commitment to holiness. And you know, it's something that I think if you reject the idea that there's anything beyond what's immediately tangible, so it's natural to reject this. But we see so much of, and this is why, you know, as I said earlier, I think it's just becoming increasingly relevant, these messages of Hanukkah, because it's very important, and it's something that, you know, we really have to be conscious to remember, is Judaism puts a great emphasis on Havdalah, on distinctions. They call the Shlachol, between Shabbos and holidays in the week, in night and dark, between the Jews and the nations of the world, and the Shabbos in the days of the week. You know, just if we go through the text of Havdalah, it doesn't mean also that, you know, the days of the week are important, Shabbos is important, that each thing has their role, but that there are distinctions that exist. And this was something that was rejected, presumably as primitive or archaic or simplistic, by the Greeks, but it's something that's very important to us. But we see something that has happened, has repeated itself in different periods in history. It's certainly, you know, communism in a very extreme way, but even in today's world, that you see, okay, so they rejected the idea of holiness, that the distinction between holiness and holy, the concept of holiness exists. But then what did they do? Okay, so they you know, if you rejected, so okay, what's the difference between purity and impurity? If, you know, it's invisible, who cares? But then they weren't content to just, you know, to just reject that idea and denigrate that idea. But one, they outlawed observances, and the Baal Turim quotes and measures, they also decreed that Jewish women couldn't immerse in a mikvah. Also, the communists destroyed many mikvahs or other periods, but also did that because also, what's the difference? You know, is this archaic? This is, you know, that doesn't make sense why there should be, you know, these different, you know, statuses or what a mikvah does. Okay, but then you could say, okay, so they didn't like religion. They were very, quote unquote, you know, rational, but we can see that first, the denigration of ideas led to an intolerance of these ideas, where it wasn't enough just to reject them, but they outlawed the practice. But then we see that it leads to actually evil and breakdown of all morality, because the Greeks decreed that all Jewish brides had to, you know, be with the foreign governor prior to their wedding night. And that's the whole story of Yehudis, of Judith, who was in this situation and, you know, slayed the governor and then, you know, and gave a chizuk, gave you know, confidence to the encouragement to the Jewish people. But you see that when you reject, okay, so first you reject more ritual things, then you outlaw them. You don't let people follow them and have freedom of religion. Then you reject distinctions between people who are married, unmarried, people who are committed to each other. So you see that there, that leads to it, to a breakdown of all morals. And in this respect, there's really a stark difference between Torah's values and Greek values. And you look at, speaking of Greek sources, so we have one Greek source, his name is Hesiod. He was a Greek poet. And in one of his poems, Works and Days, so he says, give to him who gives, but do not give to him who does not give back. What does this mean? Is it philanthropy a Greek word? So apparently the Greeks did have an idea of charity, but the idea of charity in Greek culture, in the Greek world, was to, you know, give, you know, hospitality, you know, do favors to people of the same social class. And it was a way of, you know, people within one social class, maybe bonding together, maybe even increasing one's position in the community by giving in a certain way to others. But it was really transactional. You know, there wasn't, and you see this with this quote of give to him who gives, but don't give to him who doesn't give back. Meaning the whole point in Greek philanthropy, the idea of giving, of being philanthropic, was for reciprocity. But there wasn't an emphasis on giving to those who had less, that they were viewed as inferior. It was considered that they were, if someone was poor or was lacking, it means that they were disliked by the gods. And that's why you don't really have, evidence of charitable societies in the Greek world, because it wasn't something that they valued. They valued giving. So it was really within one's class. It was really for a reciprocal value. And it was really part of the idea that this is how we build more enlightened, civilization. But the idea of compassion, of morality, of care for those who have less, of care for those who aren't either as capable physically, mentally, that was a concept that they not only didn't embrace, but rejected. And this is something that's so important to Torah values. We have a special concern for the widow, the orphan, and there is even more serious to even unintentionally discriminate against them. That we do have an idea of caring for those who have less, but the celebration of man in Greek culture was to build oneself up, but not to give to others who had less. And then this is something that was really a stark contrast between Greek values and Torah values. And this is reflected when it sums it up. The Medrash Eicha Rabbah says, it's something that's quoted frequently, that if someone tells you this chokhma b'goyim tamen, you believe them. There's really chokhma, there's clearly wisdom among the nations of the world, science, medicine, government, clearly, literature. You can't say that everyone is stupid. There's clearly wisdom among the nations, and then we clearly benefited from wisdom that's been developed in the different parts of the world. But if someone says yish Torah b'goyim, that there's Torah, that there's moral guidance that exists independently of Torah, or that's a competing system with the Torah system, don't believe him. And I think that this sums up what was really the tension and the irreconcilable difference between the Torah and Greek culture and wisdom. That there wasn't, there's emphasis on knowledge, but not an emphasis on morality. And obviously this is something that, as much as we can appreciate wisdom, if wisdom is detached from morality, is detached from any concept of holiness and of serving God, so then it's really not compatible with Judaism. And if there, and the breaking point was when when Jewish practice and observance is being influenced from the outside, from a society and from that, that doesn't share our values. Even if you could say, and you know, it's always easy to say, oh, well, if I, you know, if you lived at, you know, if you think about it, if I lived at the time, whose side would I be on? Would I be with the Hellenists? Would I be with the Maccabees? You think about other kids. If I was with Korach, would I have been with the congregation that rose up against, you know, that disputed him, or would I be with Korach? Would I be with Moshe? It's always easy to say that, you know, we'd be with the good guys, but you know, you appreciate the challenges that existed at the time. And you know, it started slowly. It started with an influence, an intellectual influence, and but then it proceeded to be a threat of dictating practice, dictating our observance of mitzvos from the outside. But, so you could say for the time, maybe you could say, oh, you know, Rosh Chodesh, what's the big deal? You know, it started small, but that was the breaking point. That when there was another society that didn't share our values and wanted to not get rid, not annihilate us physically, and not get rid of any type of Jewish learning or tradition, but threaten the idea that we observe the Torah because we want to be Ovdei Hashem, we want to be servants of Hashem, because we have a special relationship with Hashem, because life is more than just about what we can feel, just about pleasure, just about the here and now. That was the breaking point. And that's when there was the groups of people, the Hashmonaim, groups among the Jewish people who stood up against this and wouldn't allow the Greek society to you know, to penetrate into how we observe the Torah. So what does this have to do with the, you know, original question? Was why is Hanukkah described in such powerful terms? Chaviva hi ad ma'od, the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles is exceedingly precious. And I think this is it's because the choice that existed, if you were a Jew in the time of the Hashmonaim, in the times of these of the decrees, that you had to make a choice. You had to make a choice. Were you going, no one's even saying you couldn't be a Jew, but were you going to be a Jew who was a servant of Hashem, who wouldn't be influenced, at least morally, by the Greeks, or were you going to compromise? And in number 15 of the sheets, the Bach points out that this happened because the threat to Jewish practice happened because there was a significant portion of the Jewish people, including in the priesthood, who were too willing to be influenced by the Greeks. And the willingness of the Hashmonaim, the Asmoneans, called the Maccabees, to rise up against this and to not tolerate this came from an appreciation for the chavivas ha-mitzvos, for the preciousness of mitzvos. And there's another aspect of Hanukkah that I mentioned earlier in the week in Shul, that in Hanukkah there's an aspect of hiddur, of beauty, of doing mitzvos in the most optimal way. The basic mitzvah of Hanukkah candles is one candle per household. One candle per household, you know, on the eighth night, that's the basic mitzvah, you fulfill the mitzvah. But we do the, not only the mahadra, the more beautiful way, but the mahadra min mahadra, the absolute most beautiful way. You know, in Israel, there are, you know, millions of different hashgachos. You don't know what's what, you know, but, you know, it's mahajan, but mahajan, minim mahajan, mahajan, minim mahajan, the strictest of the strictest, all of the stringencies. And the Mahajan, Minimahajan, the strictest way, is to add a candle on each subsequent night of Hanukkah for Ashkenazim, for each person in the house, to even light their own menorah. That's become the practice. So we do, and that's become standard, right? You don't see menorahs with just, you know, why don't we have Hanukkah menorahs with just one candle? That's the basic mitzvah. But it's become standard. It's become almost assumed that you're going to do the mitzvah in the most mahudar, in the most beautiful way. And this, I think, reflects the fact that the Chashmonaim were unwilling, even if it was just to not, the threat was not to uproot mitzvahs, but even just to compromise the quality of our mitzvah observance. That was something that was worth standing up for. And you know, we see this with, as we said before, what's the connection between the military victory, the military, the miracle of the oil? So, Pnei Yeshua and others point out a question. We said we take it so for granted that there was only one jug of pure oil, and then they had to go. It was in 8 days to make more, to press more olives, to make more oil. So, but many ask the question: who says we couldn't have used other oils? Why do we say that? There's a concept that certainly, if you take the approach that the Jewish people were tamei meis, were impure from contact with the dead bodies, there's a concept that if the majority of the Jewish people are in that state of tuma, so then they're allowed to do many of the things that normally they would not be allowed to do. For example, the korban pesach. If someone, let's say, isn't able to be tahar before Pesach arrives, that's where Pesach Sheni comes from. People who were unable to, you know, who are burying someone and weren't able to be purified by the time Pesach comes, so they have another shot on Pesach Sheni. If it's a time where most of the Jewish people is in that state, so then there's a concept Tuma Hutra Ditzibor that Tuma is allowed if the majority of the people are impure, if there's no other option. So some say you could have just used the other oil in that situation. There is no other option. However, when the Chashmonaim were going back into the Beis HaMikdash after having been victorious, they weren't willing to restart the service in a manner that was not absolutely optimal. Sure, they could have relied on the fact that technically they maybe could have used the other oils or have done it in the situation that they were in, but they wanted to do it in the most beautiful way. They didn't want to cut any corners. They didn't want to compromise. And as a result, Hashem made a miracle. Hashem made it burn. Hashem saw how much they valued the mitzvos, how chaviv, how beloved the mitzvos were to them, that he made a miracle to show that he approved of them. So that's really, and the Beis HaLevi says this as well, that's really why, you know, it's not just having a nice esrog or other mitzvahs where maybe, yeah, there is a certain ideal of having nicer ones, but it's not necessarily so standard. When it comes to Hanukkah, the act that was the impetus for the miracle, that earned us the miracle, was the emphasis on hiddur, on beautifying a mitzvah, on doing a mitzvah in the best possible way, because mitzvahs are beloved to us. And as far as the relationship between the miracle of the oil and the military victory, so there's some discussion, which is the primary victory? So the understanding is the oil was of utmost importance, because if it was just a military victory, so in time it would just be about celebrating, you know, the winning of the, you know, Independence Day is really the signing of the Declaration of Independence, but it just like other, you know, historical, you know, celebrations, we won the war on this day, and we would have you know, taken God out of the picture. But the miracle of the oil made it clear that this was, that it shed light and clarity on the military victory, that was just as much from God as the miracle of the oil. It was just as miraculous. But I think the takeaway, the real takeaway for us, and why I really think that Hanukkah, you know, may be more relevant in 2022 than it was in you know, the second century BCE when it happened, is this whole tension between what we call Greek culture, or we call it secular culture, at least in our world, is, you know, something we have to be very careful about, very conscious of to what extent it influences our thinking and our values, let alone our performance of mitzvos, which I think really come from that. You know, we, as, you know, as I said, it's not, you can't say just like, you, well, just like, I think it would be very, you know, simplistic to say that, oh, there's nothing that Greek culture, you know, contributed. I think it would be, you know, simplistic to say that, you know, everything in the broader world has, you know, has no value. Obviously, things have value. There's been this, you know, advances in medicine and our understanding of the world. You know, this, it's not, you know, it's not so, you know, so simple to just reject everything. But we really have to be conscious about how much we're influenced, not by, as it says, the chokhmah bagoyim, the wisdom in the broader world, but the values of the broader world. And I think we see this, you know, even the last decades, last couple of years. But I mean, in every period, there are different challenges. You know, do we still think? Do we still view the world with the Torah's values, you know, or are we more influenced by the values and perspectives of the society that we live in? And I think it's a question that, you know, we have to, and certainly myself included, you know, because we are involved in the world, because we have an appreciation of the wisdom and the advances that, and the progress that has been made in the broader world, I think it's especially important to be careful about, you know, are our values the values of the Torah? You know, or is, and I could talk more about this, but I think even in parts of the religious community, it's, you know, it's something that needs to be viewed, needs to be reflected on. Is, you know, is Jewish observance, is Torah observance just, okay, I keep Shabbos, I keep kosher, it's my tradition, you know, halacha says I have to do it, and I want to be observant of halacha, so I do it. But if there's something that I can, you know, technically get around, or technically say, you know, doesn't apply today, or, you know, that I really don't accept, so what is influencing my values? Or do my, not only does my practice stem from what the Torah says, but do my values come from the Torah? Do I view the world in the way that the Torah views the world? And again, this is a something we have, from the fact that we're involved in the world, we have to be careful about it. I mean, I think in particular, you know, whatever labels we want to attach, then, you know, out of town, there's really less of a you know, focus on labels. You know, in town, there's every label for every single subset of every subset. But whatever we want to call it, I think, you know, in general, as parts of the Torah observant community that are more involved in the world, and maybe a more of a positive view of elements of the broader world, I think it's especially important that we constantly reflect on this, and that Hanukkah is especially important for us. The more we are involved or have an appreciation of the broader world. If we reject everything, so then we reject everything. There's nothing really to talk about. But if there are aspects of the broader world, we say the chokhmah bagoyim, if there's wisdom, if there are things that we do accept and we do recognize as valuable, it's especially important that we, that everything is filtered and that everything is aligned with the values of the Torah. And as long as we don't realize how much we're influenced by the thinking and the value system of the broader world, which sometimes it aligns with Torah, but many times doesn't. And you know, it's something that I think is probably the primary lesson of Hanukkah nowadays, is that we stand up not just for being Jewish, from our right to observe Jewish law and Jewish ritual and Jewish customs, but to think as Jews, to conduct our lives with appreciations for things like Kedusha, for holiness, for relationship with God, for different other boundaries and limits that the Torah says. And also a recognition that there are things that we don't know everything. There are things that exist beyond just the physical, beyond the here and now. And what we see with Hanukkah, and that we see with, if we look through history and you see how Hashem has protected the Jewish people on a whole, has protected us in our lives, is that if we commit ourselves to the values of the Torah, to unabashed observance of the Torah, to pride in our, not only our practice, but in our beliefs, in our values, a willingness to explain our values, to represent their values, and do it even though they may not be popular, we see that we can merit divine assistance, that we shouldn't throw in the towel. But the more confident we are in our Judaism, in our practice, in our values, even if the world doesn't always agree, but the more confident we are in that, the more we stand up for those things, the more Hashem will give us divine assistance to be able to continue to practice, to continue to live our lives as Jews. So we should take inspiration from the Hashmonaim, who took positions that weren't always popular, but recognized the importance of not compromising on our values, on the beauty of mitzvos and our commitment to mitzvos, and the being on guard of what elements of broader wisdom to accept, what elements are not compatible. So it should give encouragement to us. It should cause us to self-reflect, and we should by mima ein bazman hazeh. There are miracles in those days, and there are miracles in our days. They'll be rewarded for our commitment to the Torah. Afreilich and Chanukah.